The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Transmission of Light, Case 41. Tongan Daopi, the main case. Once Zen Master Yunju said, "If you want to realize such a thing, you must be such a person. Once you are such a person, why worry about such a thing?" Hearing this, Daopi was spontaneously enlightened. The verse, with empty hands seeking on one's own, coming back with empty hands, where there is fundamentally no attainment, after all, one attains. So we are moving into the twilight of this year, which I'm sure we all have our own feelings about, what this year has been. Time is something we create to measure, and in that way is something we construct, and it can be useful. And so to mark a year's passing, to mark the beginning of a new year, is a tradition perhaps in much of the world, and can be useful. And so we center our rahatsu here for that reason, in part, within the echo of the Buddha's enlightenment still resounding after 2,500 years down to this mountain. Maybe this is what Dogen's Sangha looked like in numbers anyway, when he moved to Aheji, deep in the mountains. It was a very small Sangha. Of course, he didn't have all of you. To be such a person. If you want to realize such a thing, you must be such a person. All people, all human beings have Buddha nature, enlightened nature, a mind that is the same mind as the Buddha. It's the mind of all beings. And it is, in its very nature, awake, because that's its nature. Awareness, in its nature, is always limitless, unbound, free, always present. We have the sense of losing awareness, that it comes and goes, but that's just our sense of it. Awareness never departs, is never absent, is never anything less. We have the body of a Buddha, as did Shakyamuni. And so being endowed in these ways, Nyunju said, if you want to realize such a thing, such a nature, such a mind, you must be such a person. Once you are such a person, why worry about such a thing? Only a Buddha can realize Buddha. Only a great compassionate being can realize great compassion. And so Buddhism understands, the Buddha verified, that all beings begin this way, go through our whole lives this way, and pass from this life this way. And there's not a damn thing we can do about that in the sense of increasing it or diminishing it. It's just our nature. This teacher, Dongan Daopi is two generations down from Dongshan. So this is 9th century, possibly early 10th century. There are no dates for him. And he studied with a master named Yunju, Daoying. Yunju once said to his Sangha, Buddhists of the Zen way should have a reason when they speak. Don't be careless. How can you take it easy? The Buddha spoke of this, that whenever we speak, the Buddha said we should know what we're going to say. We should understand, have a sense of whether what we are going to say is needs to be said, will be helpful to be said, the mind from which it's coming, to not be careless. And so right speech, right thought, right action, creating right karma, we might say, is based in not being careless. The precepts are about how to wield this great power of our mind, our actions, our speech, our language, without being careless. The precautions of Seshin can be understood that way. They're guiding us in how to be attentive, how to be effortful, how to be gathered in, focused, to not be careless. And careless we can think of as sort of the dispersion of our energy, the dispersion of our mindfulness, the scattering of our power. And so Seshin is sometimes described as gathering the mind, collecting the mind. Because when we are careless, we make a mess of things. We cause some trouble. It's one of the reasons that the precept of not intoxicating oneself, drink or drugs, is not so much because of the act of intoxication, but what we do, what we can do when we're intoxicated, and how we can do things that we wouldn't do otherwise, and that can have a karmic effect that goes long beyond that drunkenness, that carelessness. When we're angry and we want to hurt somebody and we know how to do that, we can be careless in our speech and our actions, even intentionally. So not being careless or being careful doesn't mean being, you know, rigid or tentative or insecure or ambivalent. It just means to be awake, really, to inside and outside, to cause and effect. It's to begin to take seriously how much impact we have, how we influence others, how much we influence ourselves, for crying out loud. And in a way, we could think of being careful as a way to rouse us out of our numbness and to calm our agitation. Those two inclinations I spoke of the other day. Numbness, we can think of as being in the realm of aversion, of basically just wanting to distance, to be away from, to say no to. And I think, you know, Shoan yesterday spoke about, you know, Zazen is not being in a frozen state. I think all of us enter into practice a bit numb, a bit frozen. And when we start to thaw out, we get understand why numbness seems like an option worth considering. Because the world's a painful place. And we have experienced pain directed towards us. We've directed it towards others. And we don't really want that to keep happening. And so we develop ways very early to guard against that. And so practice is a kind of thawing out. And so in that way, understanding that, it makes sense why we would, bringing ourselves into Zazen, why we would, we could easily, can easily sit and sort of understand or fall into Zazen in a way that continues that state. It's familiar. It seems to work. It seems to protect us. But of course, a block of ice can seem impervious from the outside, but it also is prevented from warmth and movement. Shanti Deva said, those who wish to make progress in the training should be very attentive in guarding their minds. For if they don't practice guarding the mind, they'll find it very difficult to complete the trainings. And so to be careful in guarding the mind and practicing mindfulness. That's why the senses are spoken of often as thieves, right? The gates of the senses is where the world comes in and sort of steals away our attention, or seems to. It's why emotions, strong emotional states, agitated states, can be thought of as thieves, because from within they steal away our mindfulness, our attention, our awareness. And so to free ourselves of our attachments, our false views, our familiar and ongoing cycles of behavior, so we can move freely. We can experience this life of ease and joy. We can open our hearts and not be afraid. We can face suffering and not be overwhelmed. We can be of service. We can learn how to live without regrets. In essence, we might say that that's what meticulous effort is learning how to live without regrets, without creating actions that lead to regrets, which means we also have to deal with the things we have already done that have caused us regrets. And thank goodness Buddha Dharma understands that so deeply and gives us such powerful practices, which we will engage in tomorrow night in Vasatsu. And living a life without regrets doesn't mean that we are always clear, always compassionate, always in alignment, that we're always, that we never fumble, stumble. As we continue to develop ourselves and practice and evolve and develop, the question becomes, can we do so without, with no longer being in an inner and outer battle? You know, why is it that, perhaps in the Western world at least, that going to war, fighting, battling, is such a sort of ubiquitous model? Even in our own tradition, how many references within the koans, these teachings that are all about liberation and the great peace, reference images and figures of war. So to be, find peace within this life, we have to be a person of peace. But once we are a person of peace, then we don't have to worry about it. And so, again, Shanti Deva said, it's not our purpose to disprove our experiences of sight or sound or taste or touch or thought or knowing. It's not to disprove those experiences. Rather, our aim is to undermine the very causes of our sorrow. What is that? The idea, the thought, the concept, the belief, the attachment that such phenomena have their own true existence, that they exist apart, on their own. In Dogen's fascicle on suchness, Inmo, he quoted this passage from Yunju to Daupi and said, in other words, those who think that they would like to attain the matter of suchness must themselves be people of suchness. they already are persons of suchness. So why worry about the matter of suchness? Why worry? And when we encounter these teachings, you know, why would Dogen say that? Why would Yunju say this? Because in the 9th century, 10th century, 13th century, in the time of the Buddha, people worried about such things. Am I a person of suchness? Do I have Buddha nature? Can I realize myself? Can I actually practice this path? Worry, defined as giving way to anxiety or unease, to allow our mind to dwell on difficulties and troubles. And I was reflecting on this and thinking about how through so much, not just of my life, but in particular being here, I worried about so many things, about whether I had Buddha nature, whether I could do this practice, about what my teacher thought of me, about what the Sangha thought of me, about how I was doing, about how I was carrying my responsibilities, about... It's a long list. But I didn't really think of it as worrying. I would listen to other people or hear things or see other people and think, why are they worried so much? I didn't think of what I was doing as worry. I thought of what I was doing as being concerned or taking responsibility or feeling the burden of my responsibilities, which is a way of demonstrating to myself that I was holding my responsibilities. And that's what identity does. Not recognizing that I was practicing, indulging, and getting caught in and suffering from worry. I could not practice it as worry. I saw it as other things. And as I mentioned, sometimes I saw it sort of put a positive veil on it. Yes, it's difficult, it's painful, it's a weight that I carry, but it's how I demonstrate that I care, that I'm doing my best, that I, if I'm not suffering, then I probably am not working hard enough. And that's what identity does. The way I see myself narrows my vision to that. And in narrowing that vision, what else is going on, what else I am, what this actually might be, gets shielded away. And so it's interesting to think about how this sense of self functions. And in ways that clearly cause difficulty and pain, but that when we're employing it, oftentimes we're employing it in a way that we very often can be employing it in a way that we think is necessary or has benefit or is the right thing. And that can be coming from a very sincere place. It's not like we're out to deceive ourselves. We're out to, you know, be out of touch. It can very often be coming from a place of sincerity. It's just a conditioned place. It's a habitual place. I was thinking about this, the ongoing pandemic, this reality before our eyes, this reality within our house, within the house of our world. We can hate it, we can despair over it, we can resent it, we can feel it's unfair, we could wish that it would stop. And what Yunju is saying is all the while, there is someone who is not afraid, who is not resentful, who is not despairing, who is not impatient, who is not angry, and this someone is never apart from you. That in our worry, there is someone who is not worried. And this is why faith is so important, to have faith in these teachings. So when I would hear my teacher speak about such things, in one way or another, or to practice goallessness. And I would think, I'm on board with that. I will let go of my attachment to my goal once I've attained my goal. And then I'll be happy to let it go. And when I think about all those moments, what was really happening is I was taking refuge in my mind. I was taking refuge in my view. That's what I was trusting. And I was not trusting, or I was delaying trust in my teacher's view and the view of the Dharma. I was not taking refuge there. And the thing is, it's like it happens when we're ready, pretty much. And it's one reason it's so important to hear these teachings over and over again and hear them in different ways, through different voices, from different perspectives, from different times, like a drumbeat, like a heartbeat, like a pulse. Because it has an effect when we hear it over and over again. And we are practicing. And so the teachings talk about the faith, clear faith, which is where when we encounter the teachings, we feel something, we are drawn, there's an affinity, there's a sense of yes. And then longing faith is to want to actually come closer, to experience that, what the teachings are speaking about for ourselves. A yearning faith that draws us in. And then as we with that faith, as we practice, then we begin to have experiences. Those teachings and those practices begin to have consequence, impact on us, in us, within us. So much of it is very subtle, because in the beginning, our minds are working at a level because of our lack of stability, lack of mindfulness. It's very hard for us to see the more subtle inner ways in which the Dharma is having impact. But we see enough to be encouraged, hopefully. And so that builds confidence. And as we gain confidence, that gives us the courage to have more faith. To have faith in something that we probably wouldn't have trusted before. Or to explore an aspect of the teaching or an aspect of the practice that we wouldn't have explored before. Or we might not have even heard. And so that confidence, as that confidence builds in us, it sort of expands our capacity to hear and to be receptive to. It's wonderful, really, how it works. And then how that just becomes a positive feedback loop in the sense that it's growing on itself in a positive direction. And then there's irreversible faith. When that has happened enough, so many times that we get to a point where there isn't much doubt. Right? Those doubts and insecurities and those exits we look for and, you know, all of the ways we can waver and wander really is not so much active. Dogen says, this body already is not us. Life is moved through days and months and is hard to stop even for a little while. When we try to ask where our youth has gone, there are no traces. When we observe carefully, we see that there are many things from the past which we cannot meet for a second time. The red heart does not stop. It comes and goes, piece by piece. The body already is not you. Already means before you were born. In the moment of birth, in every moment, this body already is not you. There is a body, and it is in your hand, so be careful with it. Take good care of it, because it is the body of a Buddha, and it has great power. And it can do great good. And what liberates, what explodes that potential is when we realize it is not you. It is not me. There is a body means we shouldn't be careless. We should practice. We should cultivate sincerity and faith, patience. It is not you means you are already a person of suchness. So, don't worry. The body is already not us. Life is moved through days and months. We try to ask where our youth has gone and there are no traces. I was thinking about this. I was having a conversation with Yukon, a getting older conversation. Talking about aches and pains, and because I've injured my knee and it's, you know, I've been working with it, trying to be very conscientious, loving my knees, wanting them to be healthy, because I kind of rely on them, right? They're sort of part of my occupational kit. And so not being heroic like I would have done years past, trying to be very mature, very steady, very patient. But I realized recently that all of that was true, and sort of quietly underneath all of that was, this really shouldn't be happening. Like, I'm basically healthy, my body has always sort of provided for me, and it will, and so why is this happening, actually? This shouldn't actually be happening. In other words, something's wrong. Like, why is this happening? And on that level, not accepting. And both were present. One in view, one slightly beneath view. So as we see the many things from the past, we cannot meet for a second time. The red heart does not stop. It comes and goes piece by piece. To move in accord with that, to be a person of suchness, which is to be a person without worry, without inner and outer conflict, and to be wholeheartedly engaged in the way, which can mean wholeheartedly healing, working towards healing, and to be completely at peace with the extent to which that healing may be possible. To be aspiring to come back to full health and to be at peace with not coming back to full health. That is the profound gift, challenge, invitation of non-duality. And it's a practice. All things are impermanent. All things abide within their own dharma state without moving. They don't come from somewhere. That's why you can't see where your thoughts are coming from. They're not like a thing that comes in from the other room and then leaves out the exit door, so we can't see where they go. They are not of that order. My friends and I will cease to be. My enemies, too, will cease to be. All that I hold dear to my heart will pass away, Shantideva says. And so as we come towards the end of a new year, the beginning of a new year, our clinging is what binds us. So Yunju says, above all, don't cling. If you cling, this moves us away from the Dharma. Clinging is a tangled energy, a knot within our throat, within our body, within our mind, within our actions. And so how do we untie the knot? We have to do it carefully, right? How do we practice what we consider our imperfections, those knots, those tangles? We have to do it skillfully, right? That's why skillfulness is inseparable, is embedded, is intrinsic to both wisdom and compassion. That's why wisdom and compassion are inseparable, are non-dual. And so what is happening, what we're developing in practice is learning how to practice more and more skillfully. That's part of the challenge of the intensity of training, is giving you enough of what we tend to rely upon: sleep, rest, food, so on, but not too much. And then in more intensive practice, a little bit less, so that we can see those forces moving within us of energy, of body, of emotion, of mind. We see what happens, right, when we're experiencing a little bit of stress, right? Stress is not inherently bad. It's what teaches us. It's how we, in a sense, realize we're in a body, that something's happening. And it brings us to something. And as practitioners, it brings us to the question of, how do I practice this? So if we really have faith that you never are without your complete awareness, then how do we practice that awareness in all of these different states that we find ourselves in? For instance, in Rahatsa. All of these different states. So that we're not thinking, I have to wait until such and such, and then I will be able to practice well again. That's missing an opportunity. So it's really trying to find our way in. And, you know, we're very creative and resourceful. And when we need to find what we need, we will. You know, what just came to mind was many, many years ago, I think it was Christmas Eve, and we had two very old, feeble hot water boilers in the basement, heating everything. And one of them was offline. And Jejo, who was a student from Greenhaven and the first student from Greenhaven to come and be in residence here, and had been trained as a plumber. Oh my God, what kind of good fortune was that? And so he and I went downstairs, and it was freezing. I remember that, because there was no heat. And he set about trying to fix the hot water tank, and I was trying to help. And of course, he needed things that we didn't have. And he just started looking around, and he just started picking stuff up. I swear to God, he just started picking stuff off the ground, like a twist tie, you know, and a rubber band, and just, it made it work. We can find what we need. So we have to become very skillful with working with all of those aspects that bind us, the very things we want to free ourselves of. But just saying, practice it, what does that mean, practice it? That's just a word. And it can sound monolithic, like it's one thing. Practice has no fixed form. It's very clear, it's very profoundly clear, and has been articulated and tested for 2,500 years. But it is not a thing. It is, what do I do with my mind now? What do I do with this body, with this sensation, with this emotion, with this energy, with this judgment? If you want to realize such a thing, you must be such a person. If you want to be free in such a moment, you have to be a person who is already free in such a moment. Because you are such a person, you don't have to worry in that moment of practicing that obstacle. You don't have to worry. We just practice. Dogen says, don't comment on it. Just practice it. You know, I was thinking of it like using the metaphor of the knot. It's like if you've ever had the experience of picking up a rope off the ground or off a hook, and then suddenly it's all in a tangle. But no one tied it in a knot. It's just the way we picked it up, the way it is falling together, seems to be in a tangle. And if we start pulling on it, then we create a knot. But oftentimes, if you just shake it very gently, it'll just fall fall out. And so if we think of that rope as our mindfulness, and we want to carry something, right? Or we are carrying something, something heavy, something weighty, something that is dragging on us. If we have a very, very thin cord, right, and we tie a knot to carry that heavy load, you'll never get that knot out. You have to cut it out, and you ruin the rope, ruin the cord. It's not ready yet. It's not capable yet of carrying that. We do the best we can. But when that mindfulness gets stronger, that twine, that cord becomes thick and strong, which is really the intertwining of many, many tiny, tiny little strands. Now we can carry a very heavy load and tie a knot skillfully that will easily come out with little effort. So the rope is able to hold that heavy weight and be in essentially a relaxed state. Shanti Deva says, a crazy untamed elephant in this world cannot inflict such harm as the sufferings of the deepest hell caused by the rampaging elephant of the mind. But if the elephant of our mind is secured on all sides by the rope of mindfulness, all fears will cease to exist and all virtues will fall into our hands. And so we practice within all of these very dynamic, essential, necessary tensions, patience, and urgency, wanting to be free of our suffering and accepting our suffering as it appears, having faith and dedication to the path and aspiring to and committing ourselves to practicing it while we're still standing squarely in samsara. Doing our best to practice honestly and conscientiously at the same time that there are things happening beneath our awareness that we're not aware of, that are making it murky. But within all of those tensions, where is the conflict? Where is the worry? Dogen said, it's like when a rock conceals jade. The jade doesn't know that it's concealed in the rock. And the rock, too, doesn't know that it conceals the jade. It is a person who knows it and a person who receives it. This, in other words, is not something the jade expects and it's not something the rock is waiting for. The rock doesn't rely on opinion and the jade doesn't need to think. In other words, although a person and wisdom do not know one another, it is as if the way necessarily is heard by wisdom. A beautiful way of saying this. It's like in the Lotus Sutra, when the child who wanders away from home and becomes destitute and poor and lost, and then as it says in the Lotus Sutra, one day happens to turn in the direction of home. The person and wisdom do not know each other, but it's as though the way is necessarily heard by wisdom. It's as though the person is hearing something without knowing, without recognizing, and they turn. How marvelous. In a sense, a lot of compassion in practice, in Buddha Dharma, is trying to bring ourselves and each other to just that moment of turning, where suddenly there's a possibility, there's a sense, there's a glimmer that wasn't there before. But it has to happen within the person. We can't do it for somebody. We can't shine a light in their eyes and get someone to see, and no one can shine that light in our eyes. We'll just say, you're blinding me. And that's the magic, the mystery, the wonder of practice and of us, of people, of human beings, that we are such a person. And so Maizumi Roshi said, to complete or not complete this dharma of thusness is not the matter. Enlightenment above enlightenment or delusion within delusion, these are not of consequence. Dada Roshi used to say often, some may realize it, some may not, and either way is okay. Completing or not completing, why does he say this? Because we are already a person of suchness. We don't need to worry. We don't need to measure it all out. Maizumi Roshi just says, manifest Genjo Koan. Just manifest Genjo Koan. Just manifest your true nature. And play freely in inward and outward fulfilling samadhi. This is not worrying. So Dogen says, there is a saying, without wisdom, doubt and strangeness. And because of that, eternal loss. Although wisdom is not necessarily present and not necessarily absent, it's not like something. At a particular moment, there is the presence of the spring pine and the absence of the autumn chrysanthemum. Strangeness and doubt. What is close seems far away. What is simple is so difficult. What should be natural takes deliberate action, remembering. And because of that eternal loss, we turn away from ourselves, from others, from our earth mother, from life. And so Dogen says, but even if you say that truth exists, it is not something that is bound to the vicinity of the ego self because it is suchness, because you are suchness. It is something that arouses the Bodhi mind. Once this mind arises, we throw away what we played with before and we vow to hear what has not yet been heard and we seek to verify what has not yet been verified. It is not at all our own doing. You should know this. It is thus because we are people of suchness. By what means do we know that we are people of suchness? That's a good question. By what means do we know this? And Dogen says, we know we are people of suchness because we want to attain the matter of suchness. We could not have such an aspiration if we were not already such a person. We already have the face and eyes of a person of suchness. We should not worry about this matter. Because this worry is itself a matter of suchness, it is not worry. Even worrying about it, even doubting ourselves, is itself not apart from our self-nature. Because you are alive, you are a person of suchness, a person of the Dharma, whether we practice or not. Because you are here in Rahatsu, sitting on this Bodhi seat, you already have faith in your Buddha nature. Because we are sitting on this seat, we already have faith in Buddha nature. And because we return to this seat, again and again, we already have confidence in our capacity to realize who we are. If we would only notice our own vivid example, it would help. And so as we go into our twilight of this Rahatsu, remember that the hours between sunset and sunrise have always been considered very important time. There are sutras in which the Buddha talked about traveling during the day, begging for alms, teaching his activity, and then often in the nighttime, he would go off by himself into the night and practice through the night. And so it is an important time. It's a fertile time And so as we enter into our evening, our extended night times, tonight and tomorrow, let's be aware of that, that we are practicing within this family of practitioners, of people who are people just like us, people of suchness.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.